Hello and welcome to episode 205 of the Rollo and Slappy Show. Today is June 29th, 2020. I am Rollo McFlugel and with me is Slappy Jones. Show notes page for this episode will be mcflugel.com/205, where we will link to the things we talk about. And also, this being part three of our We Answer Your Bitcoin Questions episode, we will link to the part one and two on that show notes page, or just go on wherever you listen to your podcatcher, because you should be subscribed to us, and just go back to the previous two episodes if you have not heard them yet. But I don't think it really matters what order you're listening to them, although we may kind of harken back to previous episodes. But also on the show notes page, you'll be able to find our sponsor, libertymugs.com, where you can buy libertarian and Bitcoin-themed mugs and t-shirts and some other goodies there. A little bit of other housekeeping. I was just on the Smoke Pit Storytime podcast. It got released last night, and so go give that a listen to. It's a pretty good show. It's kind of like how we do it here. It's very conversational. Just kind of pick a topic and go, and just talk off the top of our heads. But I had a tweet recently about how I thought that. Or I think that, you know, libertarianism, it's, and the non-aggression principle, it tells us how, like, the basic obligations we have to other people. So it basically says what you cannot do to other people, but it doesn't give us much insight on how we should treat other people. And I think we need something else that's outside of libertarianism, some moral, additional moral framework to help us live the good life. That tweet kind of got a little bit of attention, got a lot, some disagreement from people. So we fleshed that idea out in this podcast episode, and I thought it was really awesome. He brought up some great points, and we kind of riffed on that. So go check that out after you finish listening to us, yes. Of course.
So Rollo thinks he is really awesome.
Obviously.
All right. Well, you want to get right into
it? I've got a tractor, so tractors are awesome. Therefore, Rollo's awesome.
Okay. You want to get right?
I'm getting the tractor references out early on, so I don't mess it up anymore.
Yep. All right. So, first question.
Oh. Also, before we get into it, before I forget, too, we are running a contest. We're going to do it for one more week, where we want to update our picture for. Like the thumbnail for the podcast, kind of our yellow background with black type that just says words is kind of boring. We want to have a little more pizzazz, spice things up. So we're running a contest that whoever makes the best podcast logo for us, you're going to get a free Liberty mug and all the adulation and honor and glory that comes with knowing that you created the image for us that goes on.
We have an early leader right now.
Yeah.
So get some submissions in.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, Slappy, I think I'm done with housekeeping stuff. Let's get into it. I don't know if we're going to be able to finish.
Probably not.
Yeah.
But we'll try. So how do we maintain Bitcoin as a payment option? How do we mainstream Bitcoin as a payment option? For example, getting more businesses to accept it. We know Bitcoin fixes everything, but give us some details on how Bitcoin will actually make the Federal Reserve a useless criminal organization.
All right. I think this is an interesting question. I think it's a question or an idea that gets confused a lot of times. Because there were a lot of people that believe that Bitcoin should kind of be that medium of exchange payment first kind of deal. And I think this is how, I think there's a lot of confusion on how monetization happens and what the functions of money are and how they kind of all fit in together. And we did do an episode a little while ago explaining the monetization of Bitcoin. Actually, we did one. Oh, it was a while ago. Where we talked about
Was it just us?
I don't know. Yeah. Explaining the monetization process and the different functions of money. And then we had Car Campen on kind of recently where we were talking about why we were hodling.
Right.
Because we believe that we will have achieve monetization. And so the Bitcoin is obviously going to be way more valuable than it is now, if that is the case. So there are three functions of money. It is the, and there's a main function and the other two the main function being medium of exchange. It is the thing that is the most saleable thing in an economy. The thing that everyone demands. And so people tend to pile up a reserve of it because it is the thing that you can use in any transaction. It replaces a barter system because barter requires a coincidence of wants. And as an economy becomes more complex with more people in it, the coincidence of wants becomes way more difficult of a problem to solve. You start having to have all sorts of intermediate transactions and barters in order to go from having the thing that you have to getting the thing that you want. So money solves that problem because it's this third thing that everyone in the economy demands and wants and finds value in it. So coming from that function, the medium of exchange, there is the store of value function of money. And store of value just means that you can use it as a future medium of exchange, that you expect it to still maintain, at least maintain or appreciate in value over time. And that fulfills like what money is. Let me take a step back a second. Like, let's define what money is. Money is a thing that allows you to transport present value across time and space to deal with future uncertainty. I kind of jumbled that up. Let me try that again. Money is a tool or a thing.
Faith is a fact.
Faith is a fact. Money is a tool that is used to transport value across time and space to deal with uncertainty. I just kind of took some words out there, but
sure.
That just means that I don't know what I'm going to need tomorrow. I don't know what I'm going to need the next day after that. I might, a tornado might hit my house and I'm going to need a lot of like lumber and siding and other stuff, concrete in order to fix my house. Or I just might be living normal life and need food, fuel, energy and stuff. Or I might, there might be some other event that happens that I need some other things. So what do I hold on to? What do I have? Like, what do I do? I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. So that's why you want the thing that is what everyone else demands in the economy, the most saleable thing that I know that, that I can get whatever I want with the thing that I'm holding. So a good money is one that is going to hold its value over time. And then the third function of money is just, it's the unit of account, which means that that's how you calculate profit and loss. That's what things are priced in. So right now, an easy way to tell what your money, what the money in an economy is by seeing what prices are quoted in. So right now, at least for Americans, our money is the dollar because that's our unit of account. And that's kind of the last stage of monetization. Once you will have a new money when you have a new unit of account. So Bitcoin will become money when everything is priced in Bitcoins or Satoshis, whatever denomination of Bitcoin that we use. So how do we mainstream Bitcoin as a payment option? Well, we're still in the monetization process, and while Bitcoin is really its only purpose is as a medium of exchange, it hasn't achieved the status of a general medium of exchange yet. But since it is, does have the best monetary properties that have ever existed for something that can be a money, we are expecting it to monetize. So really, it's in its kind of store of value phase that people are expect. Store of value is kind of an interesting, maybe not the best term for this stage of monetization, because, you know, if you look at Bitcoin price fluctuation in the short term, it's pretty wild. You can really cherry pick any slice of its history and you see massive price swings up and down, backwards, forward, sideways. So really, maybe a better way to think about it is we're in a stage of value accumulation. We're speculating on this idea that Bitcoin will become the general medium of exchange, and therefore it's going to, you know, just imagine all the value going around the world or a lot of the world. And instead of that being in dollars or gold or whatever else, that's in Bitcoin. So the price of Bitcoin and the stuff that it is able to purchase is going to, you know, shoot through the roof as that continues to happen. So really, it's kind of a waiting game, unfortunately. I think that if you listen to, not unfortunately, it is what it is, but if you listen to that episode we had with Carr Campit recently about why we're hodling, how do we get it to be a payment option? Well, we get more people demanding it as payment. And that happens by making people understand the value, or not even understanding the value of Bitcoin, just starting to recognize that Bitcoin is a useful tool for them to store their value, because it's something that is going to appreciate in value. So once people start doing that, you're going to have more and more people starting demand payment in Bitcoin, and probably start charging a premium for taking payment in fiat. And so as that happens, the fiat's going to become worth less and less, because it's the demand's going to be dropping for it, while the demand for Bitcoin's going to be going up. And eventually, the premium to accept fiat's going to be infinity, which means that there is no amount of fiat that you can pay someone for them to accept it. At which case, Bitcoin becomes the general medium of exchange and becomes money. So that's Thiers' law, which states that outside of the ability for, you know, an institution like a government to enforce legal tender laws on money, the good money drives out the bad money. Do you think that, did I miss anything there?
That's about it. Unfortunately, like you said, it is what it is, but unfortunately that is the way it is. I wish Bitcoin could be money now.
Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff. I mean, we're still, most people understand Bitcoin as it is on its first layer, on the on-chain. There's being layers built on top. And once it becomes easier for people to use Bitcoin as a for day-to-day payments, it's going to be, people are going to be more likely to implement it.
But also,
and there's, this just a scary thing about, you know, you keep using Bitcoin. It's like your grandmother trying to use the internet. She's terrified of it, but she doesn't even realize. She might claim that she doesn't use the internet, and she'll claim it while she's talking to you on the phone. But she is using the internet because her phone line is using the internet. It's not using the phone like the phone lines that she kind of grew up on. It's gotten to the point, the internet has gotten so ubiquitous and so easy to use that a switch happened and she had no idea that it happened. And now she's using the internet, maybe not fully in the way that we're using it, but she's still using it.
Right. And just a note on getting people to use it as cash now. I don't think that's what you would really want. Like, you might as well spend dollars now. And you think about that, what's the story with the pizza? Someone bought two pizzas for like 10,000 Bitcoin.
Yeah, Pizza Day happened not that long ago. Yeah. So yeah, back it was like the first real Bitcoin transaction for buying something.
And like at the time, like it's I'm just using this as a story. At the time, it was pretty cool. Bitcoin was really inexpensive, and so he could probably just get 10,000 more Bitcoin, whatever. But it's a pretty cool story. He used it for a transaction, but it was 10,000 Bitcoin. I mean, what is that in today's value? Had he held that? And it's still adopted, you know, still got to where it is now. Like, it doesn't really, I don't want to spend my Bitcoin now. I would rather hold it until everyone in the world has some. The value would be so much higher, and then you can use it for.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty easy thing for someone to understand. Like, if you have something that you expect to appreciate in value, like Bitcoin, and you also have something that you expect to depreciate in value, which is the dollar, well, what are you likely to hold on to, and what are you likely going to spend?
Right.
You're going to spend the depreciating one and hold on. That's another way of explaining Thiers' law.
Right.
That's not to say that there's never a situation where, you know, it's funny. Hodling gets straw man to make it sound like, oh, Bitcoiners say that under no circumstances should you ever spend Bitcoin. Well, if you're paid in Bitcoin, as some people are, then, you know,
you kind of
probably want to spend some of that Bitcoin to like get food and shelter and do whatever else you're going to do. But what's kind of interesting is that since it appreciates in value so much, it's probably going to make you lower your time preference a little bit and spend less stuff on frivolous things, maybe be a little bit more frugal because, you know, these things aren't, you know, the Bitcoin's gonna be worth so much more than whatever junk you might otherwise buy with it. So I think that's how, to answer the second part of the question, how will we make the Federal Reserve a useless criminal organization, is that Bitcoin's gonna make it obsolete because people are just going to reject using the dollar just because it doesn't perform as money as well as Bitcoin. You know, the nature of Bitcoin that, here's a good, so a story just came out that it was like 83 tons of gold were just made to make some sort of payment. And after the payment was received, the gold was received and the other side of the transaction went through, they discovered that, the bars were gilded copper. So compared to the value of 83 tons of gold, it was largely worthless.
Right.
No one assayed the gold. No one validated it. And so they were sent counterfeit gold. And to their defense, to their defense, it's, you know, if you're accepting 83 tons of gold in payment, you might want to take a slither of that money to put towards making sure that it's legitimate, but it takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of cost. It takes a lot of specialized equipment to validate that the gold you're getting is pure gold.
On top of that, getting 83 tons of gold from point A to point B can't be cheap.
Yeah. It's really freaking expensive. But Bitcoin, all you need to do is run a full node and you can fully validate any payment that you're receiving. Instantly, just about it. Well, not instantly. It takes a couple milliseconds for your software to run it back and audit the blockchain to make sure that the Bitcoin you're getting sent is legitimate and use the correct rules to get there. And you know, it's pretty cheap to do that, to send a transaction in Bitcoin as, you know, send whatever it costs to send those 83 tons of gold, like you said, is going to be really, really expensive. That equivalent, And depending on, we talked about last episodes, the UTXOs, UTXOs, depending on how many different UTXOs that you'd have to kind of gather together. But let's just say it was a few, and it was the transaction size, as in the disk space that was required was on the, average size. A lot of cases that transaction would only take a buck, maybe. A lot of recent times it's been less than a dollar. And, assuming it gets put on the next block after you send the transaction, you're going to have to wait a bunch of, more than six confirmations for however much value they're transmitting there. But let's just say you wait a day just to be really, 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 really sure that enough proof of work is built on top of that transaction. I guarantee it took longer than a day to send those 83 tons of gold.
Yeah.
And way cheaper, and the validation was instant. Virtually instant, and the validation basically cost you the amount that it takes for you to run your node in that little bit of time. So that allows the barriers to entry to act like a central bank currently does to basically anyone with a low-end hardware and low-end internet connection. So the amount of capital required, the amount of people you have to know,
people all of
the red, yeah, all the red tape people have to bribe in order to be operate as a bank, not just a bank, but a central bank. Bitcoin just makes it magnitudes upon magnitudes of order easier to do that. I also wrote an article about why libertarians, I think it's called Dear Libertarians, Bitcoin Fixes This. And it kind of gives a quick rundown of what happens as the Federal Reserve loses power because people are using dollars less. They're not going to be able to do as much. And maybe a government survives by starting to use Bitcoin, but now they can't inflate it like they did dollars. And so now, in order to do stuff, they have to directly tax people. So they can't just like use inflation to kind of hide the theft and hide what they're doing to people's wealth. They have to directly tax it in order to do stuff. So it's going to make them have to pull back real hard and not be as aggressive with their spending.
Be really careful where you drop those bombs.
Yeah. And really do a lot less in order to only do the quote essentials of government. And eventually this is going to kind of allow people to save more money, lower their time preference because of that ability to save. And so there's going to be a lot more capital improvements in the marketplace. And with those capital improvements, a lot of technological advancement. And so as that happens, even these services that might be deemed essential that the government does it, the market's going to figure out ways to do it better and for cheaper. And so it's just going to obsolete the government in general. And also while this is happening, I'm going to save this point for something else.
Yeah.
Because there's another question.
All right.
And also I don't want to spend,
Now that we're 23 minutes in.
Yeah. We spent 20 minutes on that question, but it was a good question. And I think it's, it just goes to show how many rabbit holes you can go down and how all this stuff is built on top of each other. But let's go to the next one.
All right. Bitcoin uses blockchain, which is a service for authentication and a ledger. Bitcoin has a reputation for being private and anonymous, like digital cash. Doesn't blockchain make Bitcoin trackable? And not just trackable, but allow everyone to know who that Bitcoin has been owned by.
Okay, so we kind of answered this in a previous episode, but I like...
Briefly.
What's that?
Yeah, we'll answer. We will answer it again.
Yeah, because I think this is what I like, is that different people ask questions in different ways. And so I kind of like the way that he asked this. So let me kind of go backwards with the question. He says, it's not just trackable, but allow everyone to know who that Bitcoin has been owned by. That's actually a feature of Bitcoin, is that everything is traceable. Every transaction is trackable, because if you can't track what every transaction has been and where it's been, then you can't track it all the way back to its Coinbase transaction, which was when Bitcoin was originally mined. So that's how we verify Bitcoin scarcity. That's how we audit the supply. And that strict supply of 21 million Bitcoins is what makes it one of the major things that makes it very valuable as a money, because it's of that digital scarcity. Because that's very high stock to flow ratio. So that's a feature. Now, that's a good question. It's like, all right, well, if it's all trackable, then, what about privacy? We don't want people knowing exactly what our transactions are, even if we're not doing anything, quote, wrong, unquote. It's still kind of creepy knowing if people know what you're doing with your money. So that's why, although everything is on, in the blockchain there forever and ever on all these, this distributed network of nodes, each having a copy of it, Bitcoin is pseudonymous. So if you don't attach identifiable information to your Bitcoin addresses, then there's really not much of a way. It would be difficult to figure out who you are. And then just to kind of briefly go over the other stuff, there's coin mixing. There's ways to get Bitcoin more anonymously, like Bisc. And there's other layers that you can use on top of Bitcoin. The Lightning Network allows some improvements on privacy, because you kind of take a chunk of Bitcoin. Just imagine an abacus that between two people, and you can kind of spread this out in a network that could be pretty interesting. That, like, say, Slappy and I open a channel together where we each put up one Bitcoin, and then we can move the Satoshis in each of those Bitcoins back and forth on the abacus, and the rest of the blockchain, the rest of the network only sees it once we close that channel and resettle on the blockchain. But where those beads on that abacus are going, no one really sees that. Or at least it's more difficult. It improves privacy. There's no such thing. There's never anything as perfect privacy, but it certainly improves it. There's also things like the side chains, like Liquid right now is kind of the big one. It's got its trade-offs. I'm not saying it's a, silver bullet, of course, but you can improve privacy there. And then there's all sorts of, we talked about it, it already kind of touched on it, and we talked about in the previous episodes that, there's going to be layers on top of Bitcoin that are going to get built that will very likely solve a lot of these problems. So, like we said early on in that first episode of this series, is that if you want to get into Bitcoin right now, you're a pioneer, and things aren't going to be perfectly smooth for you. Might be a little bit of a learning curve, but that's the price you pay for something that's so early that you're a speculator on.
All right, next question.
Okay, yep.
Yeah. So how do you start with Bitcoin if you know nothing about computers? This is also something we talked about in previous episodes.
Yeah, I would say 10 hours of Bitcoin.com. Start there.
Yeah, and if you really just want to start with it, go on Cash App and buy some.
Yeah.
And now you have
get
some.
A little bit.
And now
download a wallet on your phone.
And from there,
try to send the Bitcoin.
Yeah, from there, figure out the rest of it. Go to 10 hours of Bitcoin, but then you can at least get in the game and have some.
Yeah, it's really not as hard as people make it out to be. I mean, there's certain things, like if you want to really talk about, you know, improving your privacy, really having high security for your private keys, you know, like anything else, and especially with Bitcoin, you can get into the weeds really quick. But just like basic functionality of Bitcoin, sending and receiving transactions, it's really not that difficult. But yeah, 10 hours of Bitcoin.com. I also suggest you start immersing yourself in like podcasts. So if you go to mcflugel.com/Bitcoin, I've got a list of the podcasts I listen to. They're on Bitcoin, but a few of them are the Noted Bitcoin Podcast, Tales from the Crypt, Bitcoin Audible with Guy Swan, who's been a guest on this show before. It used to be called The Crypto Economy, but he changed the branding to Bitcoin Audible. And then Stefan Levera Podcast is another good one. Citizen Bitcoin. And Mr. Sue's podcast, A Boy Named Sue. He does a lot of Bitcoin stuff there. So plenty of J.W. Weatherman's Bitcoin Odyssey. He hasn't posted anything new there for a while, but he's got a really good backlog of stuff. And also there's books I have listed there. So if you want to learn the technical side of Bitcoin, then I think the best book out there for that is Grokking Bitcoin. You don't need to understand a lick of computers to understand Bitcoin the way he wrote it. He explained it the parallel he uses for the Bitcoin network is a company that tracks how many cookies the employees have. So it's a really clever way to kind of explain Bitcoin in a parallel way to make it really simple. So
I haven't read it, but maybe I will.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good one.
Okay, so what happens when governments ban BTC? Tough to onboard people now, and if becomes illegal, will make it almost impossible.
So we had another Car Campit reference. We had an episode talking about, and we talked about this in previous episodes, in the previous parts here, that I don't think that all governments are going to, in the first time in the history of the world, all work together and do something. So I think there's a lot of game theory involved with different governments either being tough on Bitcoin or supportive of Bitcoin. And I think that's going to create arbitrage for global wealth to move around countries. It's also going to create a lot of brain drain if you know, smart minds that are working in Bitcoin or industries that are close to Bitcoin, it might make people move around. And so countries that are friendlier to Bitcoin, they're going to get more wealth. They're going to get more intelligent people. And it's going to hurt governments that try to ban Bitcoin. The other thing too, and this is where I was answering in the first question where I stopped myself, but in that piece I wrote, Dear Libertarians, Bitcoin Fixes This, one of the things you have to consider is that as Bitcoin's monetizing and appreciating in value, and the fiat is depreciating in value at a much higher rate because Bitcoin's taking over much more of the market for money, is the government still have to pay their goons. And as private industry starts taking bigger and bigger chunks out of government services, and you know, we would presume that these private industries are going to be paying people in Bitcoin, you're going to lose a lot of talent. Government's going to lose a lot of talent, whether it's mental talent or physical talent for their goons. People are going to want to get paid in Bitcoin and not government's fiat. So it's going to be difficult for governments to have money to pay people to do their enforcement. So it's governments are in a real bad spot. It's one of those, it's like they're damned if they do, damned if they don't. And that's why Bitcoin's so exciting.
All right. Should we skip this next question?
No.
Okay. What is the usability of Bitcoin at this point? What day-to-day transactions accept it? The reason I was going to say skip it is we kind of touched on it earlier, but
yeah, we did. We did basically answer it. Bitcoin. I mean, there are. if you go to mcflugel.com/bitcoin for our Bitcoin resources pages, one of the sections I have is where you can spend Bitcoin, and I would like to claim that the only good place to spend Bitcoin is at libertymugs.com.
And you should spend actually, all of it there, actually.
Yeah, actually, I think I have to. There's something wrong with the with that payment processing for Bitcoin that I have to fix. Give me a second, and let me fix that before you spend all your Bitcoin there. But no, there's plenty of websites out there that are that accept Bitcoin if you want to spend it. But like we said, why do you want to spend Bitcoin right now if you think it's going to appreciate in value? The real usability of Bitcoin is that you have a way to save and accumulate wealth that is independent of the decisions and actions of government. So they can't inflate Bitcoin. They have no way of doing that. Right now, the usability of Bitcoin, it is a incredible savings vehicle. Day-to-day transactions would accept it, you know. It's out there, but I don't know why you would want to do it.
All right. Agreed. This was also a question we answered in, I think, the first one. But
let's answer it again.
Okay. Do you like Bitcoin?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So do I. What is the probability of a Bitcoin block being censored or otherwise altered or attacked after 6 confirmations?
I wasn't doing the timestamps very well. So I'm catching up. Tried to make it easier and I didn't do it. Okay. What is the probability of a block being censored or otherwise altered or attacked after 6 confirmations? Very low. So what this means, so let's explain what he's kind of asking. What he's talking about is, what is the likelihood of a 51% attack? And what that means is that a miner controls at least 51% of the hash rate in the Bitcoin network, the ability to produce the proof of work for it. So what that means is that when you have over 50%, and you have a simple majority, you have the ability to rewrite previous blocks. It's a mathematical likelihood inevitability that by having more hash power than everyone else that you can, given enough time, redo the chain with enough proof of work that you can replace what's existing. Now, the key there, don't get nervous, don't get scared. The key there is if you have enough time. And with that time, because you're going to be mining, comes cost because you need to, use up electricity. So it would take the less of a majority that you have, the time it would take, it like goes through the roof. I don't know if it's exactly exponential, but like it's that kind of deal. Mm-hmm. The time it would take for a miner with 51% of the hash rate to be able to you know, redo six previously confirmed blocks would take an enormous amount of time, which means that it would take an enormous amount of cost. And so it is way more profitable for them to just mine,
new Bitcoin.
Yeah, mine on the up and up, play by the rules and try to cheat it. And that's why proof of work with the difficulty adjustment and everything makes Bitcoin be able to work, is because it properly aligns incentives. But there might be a case where you send, like going back to that 83 ton gold transaction, I don't know how much Bitcoin that would be worth, but it would be a whole lot. So you want to make sure that you wait for enough confirmations for it to not to be profitable for them to try to 51% attack the network, and so they can double spend that transaction. So it's, if let's just say that's $1 billion, that 83 tons of gold. If you make a $1 billion transaction on Bitcoin, you don't accept that transaction as being complete and confirmed on the network until you've had at least $1 billion worth of proof of work built on top of that transaction's block in terms of confirmations. Does that make sense?
Sure. I'm not as savvy with how that stuff works. So
yeah, it can get into I'm trying to not start from square one and explain
right
mining and everything, and there's charts that show like the likelihood and probability of 51% attacks, depending on how much of the network you have and how many blocks you're trying to rewrite. But the big thing to come away with is that the incentives are aligned well. The way that the mining and everything has been built, that it aligns incentives well, that it's not worth it to try to cheat the system. It makes everyone who's going to put extend resources to the Bitcoin network to put it to mining new blocks and not trying to cheat, which is really good for security because you don't really have that good of an incentive. Any energy that's going to be to put towards Bitcoin is going to be used to secure it and not attack it.
Right.
Even though, and these people are all operating on their own, in their own self-interest, not being like, oh, we should work together. It's not, we should work together. It's, this is what works best for me. So on the other hand, if you've got a small transaction, you know, you're sending $5 worth of Bitcoin somewhere, it might actually even be worth it to accept a zero conf transaction, which means that you don't even wait for it to get to confirmed once, because it's not even worth it for the guy to try to double spend you. Or, you know, maybe one confirmation is enough, because $5 worth of Bitcoin, there's way more dollars worth of energy that is put into a single block in your one confirmation than there is in that $5 transaction. So that person would be pretty crazy to try to double spend a $5 transaction. And just, I mentioned double spending a few times, and double spending just means that a person signs the keys to move Bitcoin somewhere, and then they re-sign, they attempt to re-sign that Bitcoin and send it back to themselves, and then they have to try to get a chain. Okay, so I got to go back a little bit further. So nodes on the network accept the chain with the most proof of work. And so if I want to send Slappy, if I want to double spend Slappy, Slappy's going to sell me his car. And so I send Slappy 5 Bitcoins. And he sees it, and it's confirmed on the on the blockchain. And
so he says, okay, great. Car.
Here's the car.
Here's the
I got
key.
My Bitcoin. Yep.
Title.
And so what I do is I have the ability to – I talk to a miner, or let's just say I'm a miner. Make it easy. Take some steps out. And I start mining kind of on the side. And I've got – if I've got at least 50% of the network hash power, I have the ability to maybe do this. Takes an extreme lot of luck to do it without bankrupting myself, but maybe it's worth it.
I have a really nice car, by the way. So this is an expensive transaction.
Yes. So what I do is on the side, I start building my own block that has that same Bitcoin that I sent to Slappy spent back to an address that I own. It's spent back to me. And so while that the original transaction is getting blocks put on top of it, I have to build this little chain on the side. I've got to catch up with the main chain. And as soon as I add more blocks, have more accumulated proof of work on my little side chain than is on the main Bitcoin blockchain, I can release that to the network. And since the nodes, they take as truth in the network as the chain with the most proof of work, will abandon that previous chain that had Slappy in possession of those, what was it, 5 Bitcoin? And it'll accept the chain with that 5 Bitcoin being sent to me.
And so then you'll have the car and the Bitcoin.
Then I'll have the car and the Bitcoin. Now, this is very expensive because, and it's a huge risk to me because while I'm building my little side chain, adding blocks, the rest of the network with all of their accumulated proof of work is adding to that main chain. So, you know, the likelihood of me being able to outstrip them in solving blocks is very, 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 very low. So I would probably bankrupt myself, or at least.
But hey, if you win, you get your 5 Bitcoin back.
Yeah, make it so that I end up losing a lot of money in the whole thing. So kind of got in the weeds there. I didn't explain everything so well. Kind of jumped around, but hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was good enough.
Yep.
All right, we probably have time for one or two more.
Man, we're almost 48 minutes in.
Yep. So how to keep people from buying so my family is in a better position at the Citadel?
Yeah, so you got to do the opposite and tell people how bad Bitcoin is and how great fiat is.
And just talk about how dollars are the future. Store your wealth in dollars. Put them under your mattress. Leave them there. And then spend them someday.
Yeah, maybe you can try to do a 51% attack on the network to make people lose trust for a little bit so they dump their Bitcoin. Please don't do that.
Go ahead and try.
No, but in case, and this is a topic I've wanted to talk about for a little bit, but the idea of a citadel is just, it's kind of a meme in the Bitcoin world where someone wrote this Reddit post where he claimed to be from the future, where he said that, you know, Bitcoiners live in these things called citadels, that they've kind of escaped to that allows them to kind of live away from the fiat society, and it kind of protects them. I think it was an interesting little post this guy wrote. I think he got a lot.
Now
of
you're
stuff
saying
wrong.
He was from the future.
We don't know for sure.
Okay.
There's no way to disprove him, I guess. But I think what a citadel in practice is just going to be, you know, like gated communities. it's going to be less, a little bit less exciting than the idea of these, like, you know, basically castle looking things where Bitcoiners live. But who knows? Maybe yeah. we'll have castles.
Yeah. With a drawbridge.
Yes.
What's the easiest way to get started with Bitcoin? How does Bitcoin compare to other cryptocurrencies? Again, I think the first question we answered.
Yeah, go to 10hoursofbitcoin.com and, like Slappy said, download Cash App or something. And, you know, you can, I think it's as little as a dollar's worth of Bitcoin, probably less than that.
I think you can get a dollar, maybe less, but you can get it. And then you can, from there, learn how to send it to another wallet.
Yeah. Put a wallet on your phone, put a wallet on your desktop computer. The nice thing about, you know, we talked about all the privacy stuff and the, and a little bit of security stuff in past episodes, maybe. The great thing about, you know, getting $5 worth of Bitcoin is that no one's going to try to steal it from you.
Yeah.
Because it's just not worth it. So you don't have to worry about being, hyper secure. And, you know, you don't want to, you know, dox yourself and be stupid about it. But
or send your private keys to Rollo.
Right. Well, you can do that. I won't.
Keep them safe.
Yeah. But you don't have to worry about having like some super hardcore cold storage set up or, you know, do I need to buy a hardware wallet for $5 worth of Bitcoin? No, I don't think so. But it's just play around with it. If you screw up, you lost $5. Like, don't try not to screw up, obviously. But if you screw up, then, hey, you've lost $5. And that's whatever lessons you learn from losing $5 is
much valuable, much more valuable than the $5.
Yes, exactly. And also, you know, for getting started with learning, go to 10hoursofbitcoin.com and also go to our Bitcoin resource page where we will mcflugel.com/Bitcoin, where we kind of direct you to a lot of podcasts, books, and other sites out there. Bitcoin-only.com is a great resource too. How does Bitcoin compare to other cryptocurrencies? Well, I'll put it this way. They don't compare to other crypto. The other cryptocurrencies don't compare to Bitcoin. A lot of them are just copies. None of them have the hardness or security of Bitcoin. They don't have the networks. So like you might have this coin you think is the greatest thing in the world. It's got all these great properties. But like if no one's running your software, no one's on your network, then you can't really do anything with it because you have no one to interact with on it. Think of it as like social media, like Twitter. That's where basically everybody is. And you've got things like Gab and this other thing that just came up, Parler, and a couple other social media networks are popping up. And maybe they have things that are better about them, but they don't have the networks that Twitter has. They don't have the same number of people that Twitter has. Twitter's got a massive amount of users, and that's the thing that really makes Twitter valuable, is that you can use that to communicate to huge numbers of people, where maybe Gab has certain features and services that are we can like sit there and say, oh, this is better. This is better than Twitter. But since you don't have access to the network that Twitter does, that's what really harms its value. And the difference between like, you know, talk about Twitter and social media versus Bitcoin is that Bitcoin is a winner take all kind of get money is a winner take all kind of thing. Social networks have that a little bit, but we can look and see like, oh, we've got Facebook and Twitter and a couple other major social media networks out there that a few of them can exist at the same time. Whereas if Bitcoin becomes money, or for anything to become money, that means all others have to basically go away. At least in that, I think that's another issue that people kind of get confused about is that I say, oh, Bitcoin's going to become global money. And they say, but we have multiple monies here. Well, Bitcoin kind of breaks legal tender laws, makes them obsolete. And the other thing is these monies develop and these networks around some of these other, well, might be better to call them currencies around the world. They developed before we had a lot of economic interconnection. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have all this international trade happening. We didn't have the ability. The internet gives you the ability to do transactions pretty regularly and easily with people on the other side of the world. And there's an intermediate step where a bunch of centralized actors have to help you do business with someone in China because you've got US dollars, they've got the yuan, and so there needs to be a trade there to exchange those currencies in order for him to get the value of the dollars that you're sending to him in the yuan. It would make a lot more sense to not have to have that barter step with the exchanging the currencies and just all, if you're all operating in the same economy, that you all use the same money. All right.
All right.
You want to stop there?
Sure.
Because I think that gives us just enough to do part four.
Cool.
And there's some pretty good questions that are still remaining. So I'm excited about it. So, all right. I'm going to try to get some of the resources, like the, we mentioned the episodes with Carr. I mentioned that article I wrote, the Dear Libertarians thing. I think that was it. I don't think there are really that many other resources or references that I made. If there is and you can't find it, let me know and I'll get it for you. But anyone, if you have any more questions out of this or if we didn't answer something or it was a little bit confused, feel free to hit us up, let us know. And that offer of coming on the show and just kind of having a conversation and answering questions and talking through this stuff is on the table. I think that would be, it's sometimes difficult to, have a one or two sentence question and try to answer it in a way that's satisfactory to someone who actually has that question. But when you can have a back and forth, I think it can be a lot more fruitful. So let us know. Again, our show notes page will be mcflugel.com/205. Be sure to check out libertymugs.com. If you've got an idea for a logo, you've got a week. We will announce it in next week's episode, who the winner is. So that'll be exciting. So get your submissions in. If you have any questions or anything, hit us up on Twitter or something. DMs are open. Also, like this, wherever you're listening to this podcast, give us a like, give us a share, make sure you subscribe. That's the best thing you can do for us. We want to reach more people. I think this is going well. We've gotten some good feedback from people that are listening to these episodes. I think it's really fun. I love talking about Bitcoin. It also helps me because it's one thing to kind of have these ideas floating around in your head and understanding it. It's another thing to try to verbalize it and talk through it. So this is a very good exercise for me to try to build up my ability to defend Bitcoin and also learn and figure out ways to not try to have to explain from from square one everything to come up with good ways to kind of jump in and just answer the question without being like, well, there was these things called Yap Stones and or Rye Stones on the island of Yap. So this is fun. And we're going to have we're just about to hit an hour here. So
cool.
Don't want to overload you anyway with stuff. So, all right, Slappy, you have anything, anything you want to sign off on?
Yeah, we'll pick it up again next week.
Oh, you know what? We need to do a free market success story.
Indeed.
Something felt missing. Do you have one?
No.
So, the Denver Libertarian, I guess it was last week, he sent me a DM, and I'm just going to read it. Said, if you ever need, or you are ever in need of a free market success story, here you go. I was at a brewery, nice outdoor area, always have a food truck there, but usually end up standing in line for 24 minutes to order and then wait around 10 minutes for the food. COVID regs, boo, say no lines for food trucks. There's an app that lets you find food trucks, place order online while slugging beer, and they text you when it's ready. Far better experience. Maybe this app has been out for a while and I didn't know about it, but I'm happy to know about it.
That's fantastic.
I think that's pretty good. Yeah, that's pretty good. I think there's a lot of room in these kind of spaces for technological improvements. Like I saw someone the other day say it's like kind of a travesty that most restaurants don't have a little thing at your table where you can pay for the bill right there. Mm-hmm. But I think we'll get there sooner rather than later. But thank you, Denver Libertarian. That's a great one. And we'd love to hear your free market success stories too. So hit us up with them when you got them.
Yeah.
Alrighty then. I guess that's it. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
Hey, rate us 5 stars. Peace.